In Washington, D.C. right now is 41 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 38 degrees and mostly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features COP29, climate justice shortchanged. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Moisa Muntali. The music in the background is Flight Time by Donald Byrd. And we play that remembering Donald Byrd's birthday, which is December 9. Today, Africa Now is following up from our show of 3 weeks ago during the first days of the UN Climate Change Conference in Baku, Azerbaijan. The conference was scheduled from November 11 to November 22nd. And it was the 29th annual meeting of the Conference of the Parties, COP29, of the 1992 UN Climate Agreement, United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC. The agreement was put into force in 1994, 30 years ago this year. COP29 ended a day later than scheduled. At the end, the Global North pledged to provide $300 billion to the Global South in assisting it to move to a low-carbon economy and adapt its infrastructure to handle the impacts of extreme weather. The Global South had demanded at least $1 trillion. Thus, members of the Global South walked out of the negotiation rooms. Representatives of the Global South were quoted in the Guardian newspaper saying, "We are outraged and deeply hurt by the outcome of COP29. Once again, the countries most responsible for the climate crisis have failed us. This is not just a failure, it's a betrayal." Yesterday, I had a conversation with Dakar-based activist Mohamed Lamine Sadja Khan, who is head of Building Power Department at the Climate Action Network International, that's CAN International. Mohamed Lamine Sadja Khan attended the climate conference in Baku. The conversation dissects the outcomes of COP29, the continuous unmet pledges by the Global North, countries heavily responsible for climate change, unmet demands of climate justice for countries most impacted by climate change, fossil fuels industry's negative impact, next steps, and more. Here is the conversation. Mohamed Lamine Sadja Khan, welcome back to the show.
Great, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks again for taking the time out of your busy schedule. And also, I know you're just recuperating from illness, so just an accident, but so thank you again for really taking that time to be with us. I know it's under these circumstances. First, I just wanted to ask you the atmosphere, the mood at the close of COP29 in Baku, since you were there for that conference, and particularly the Global South's reaction to the final pledge by the Global North.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And I will also say, your words of care really help on my recovery. But just let me quickly start saying that This year is a critical year for climate, as I've been said in the last show, as it is about finance. And when you talk about climate, at the center of addressing climate challenges is you have to have finance on the table so that the Global South and developing world can be able to adapt to the crisis and the catastrophe of climate that they have not been made a major responsible of. At the tail end of the COP 29, we've seen frustrations. We've seen in the eyes of the Global North, Global South community and people who are affected by the climate crisis, you know, feeling very disappointed that people went to Baku, people from the Global South went to Baku with the hope that there'll be finance on the table. They went with an realistic, figures of at least 1.3 trillion grant-based finance to be agreed by leaders, especially those from the Global North, who have failed to fulfill the promise of 100 billion annually. We believe that, with this push, they would have realized their mistakes and make steps to take more ambitious, contribution to climate. If you look at 1.3 trillion to be annual-based, grant-based finance, is less than 10% of money that is being put on wars that is funded, that's been used for wars or supporting wars by the developed world. So it's just disappointing to see that number have been downplayed, and then we did not see anything until the tail end to see, being proposed. They force gave us a blank check to say there'll be so X number will be allocated. Then for a few days, then they came back with a 250 billion. It's like, what? This cannot be allowed. We cannot accept it. People started pushing back. Developing countries started pushing back. Least developed countries frustrated. Some of them, got very disappointed. Then they increased it to 300 billion. But the 300 billion in itself is not just all about. It's not all money on the table. But it is coming with conditions. It's saying that, there'll be low interest rate finance, low interest rate loans given as part of the 300 billion. But again, it's also saying that, the allocation of 300 billion will have to be supported by the multinational development, multilateral development banks, the MDBs, the World Bank and all of these regional banks. And we all know those banks are made to make profit. So that it's like another chain of colonization being put on the heads and the neck of the struggling developing countries around addressing climate. I want to say it's just so sad that the people who are responsible, the richer nations who are responsible for the climate crisis, refuse to take the responsibility and put real money on the table by refusing that, they kind of captured the cup from the presidency, and then they did what favors them or what pleased them, and we have to come out with a very disappointing outcome of this cup.
And members of the Global South did walk out at the end, right? So that's the reports I saw, that members of the Global South walked out. This is when they heard the agreement was going to be, not the agreement, that the Global North would be providing 300 billion is what they were putting on the table.
Yeah, a lot of least developed countries have felt so disappointed. In the negotiations room, during the negotiations, some of them had left the negotiation room because they could not take what they are hearing, that the developed world countries are not really ready to compromise and increase, because they had to come to a push on agreement to say, oh, we can take 600 billion, if you guys put it at 600 billion, we can even come down to 500 billion, but they are not even listening to them at all. So they are like, you know what, we can't continue to listen to you. So the negotiation did not continue. They left the negotiation rooms. They did not walk out of the COP, but they left the negotiation rooms. And then you can see clearly how the concluding remarks from some of them, like Nigeria, India, and others, you know, they have been very clear and that we are rejecting this particular outcome. We cannot accept this. This has to be renegotiated. So we hope that, you know, as we go to SBs, the intersections in June, there'll be more discussions, but again, as well as we go into COP30, there'll be more rigorous discussions with the Global North and, you know, make them accountable and make them, you know, do the right for by putting money on the proper money.
And as we discussed in our earlier conversations about 3 weeks ago, when you were just starting the conference, when the COP29 was just beginning, when you were in Baku at that time when we talked to you, we had talked about how some activists like Greta Thunberg had criticized COP29 taking place in another fossil fuel producing country. Last year it was in Dubai, UAE. Thus, she called it a greenwash conference. And she, not just her, but others as well. You had also said, yes, this was basically a greenwash conference. Did the ending of the proceedings of COP29 throughout, did that confirm those sentiments that this was just basically a greenwash conference?
Yeah, we have not seen any major shift from what have been anticipated to be in this hub. There have not been any move or step towards, you know, seeing a phase out of fossil fuels in this COP. We in Dubai, you know, we had this language on the cover page that there'll be a phase out, there should be a phase out, or there'll be a phase out of fossil fuels. But then how will it be done was not, you know, deliberated in the decision. This COP did not take it further, did not talk about the finance bit of it, did not talk about the equity bit of it. With all the push that activists have been pushing for, we've not seen any major commitment that have been made. Even there is a whole downplay around the just transition work program. So there is a whole, you know, a challenge when you host a COP in a country that is what is called a petrol state, or a country that depends on fossil fuels for its economy, because I think the world needs to show example of transition. I would love to see COPs hosted in countries like Colombia that have hosted COP16. You know, they have been a champion of transition. They are a commitment in terms of alternative development economy that shows that, you know, we cannot depend on the fossil industry economy to survive, to continue to survive. We need to transition into more alternative, renewable development economy that will help save lives, but also save the planet. That's what is, that's those are the countries that we're supposed to be seeing COPs hosted in. But, you know, as we speak right now, you know, after Brazil, there's another petrol state that is thinking of hosting COP, like Australia, you know. So we are, it's like this whole space is kind of been hijacked, or, you know, by fossil fuel industry and the capitalist industry that is advancing that kind of economy. So it's just unfortunate that the leadership of these meetings are allowing these very important processes to be captured.
Again, that's Dakar-based activist Mohamed Lamine Sajakan. He's head of a Building Power Department at the Climate Action Network, CAN International. And we are dissecting COP29, Conference of the Parties, that took place in Baku. We just recently ended And it was the conference that took place in November 11th to the 22nd. It was scheduled to end on the 22nd, but it ended a day or two later. But as you're talking about the next conferences, to just so that people are up to date, so the next COP would be in Brazil, and then after that, you're saying Australia also would like to do COP 31.
Yes.
Yeah, 31. So, and people are thinking, so the sentiment within, like, especially in the environmental activist community and as well as the Global South, they're looking at Brazil as really a key point in the in these conferences. This would be the 30th one, and it's since 1994 there was when the climate action the agreements were signed. This would be the 30th conference. So they're seeing that as a big milestone. Do you think that there'll be more successes there because Brazil has more commitment towards dealing with climate change issues?
Yeah, there is a clear hope from the Global South, but also from the activist community, that we have been having these COPs in very repressive regimes or repressive countries, that these COPs from Egypt to Dubai to Azerbaijan, Baku, we have been having these COPs in closed spaces where we are not allowed to, you know, to protest or even do, you know, big public marches. Everything have to be done inside. So we have to be innovative and do our things inside. Especially the Baku one was so frustrating because everything is covered. It's like done in a stadium. We are all in tents, under big covered tents. So actions that we do to communicate the messages and our demands into actionable photos and visuals were not done publicly properly. So because of the limitations that have been surrounding the host nations or host country. There is hope that Brazil, in fact, with our democracy, with the leadership, there'll be more public engagement into climate discussions and the climate talks. So more public facing and public processes. But again, the progressive nature of Brazil's leadership, we hope to see more, you know, strong outcome from COP 30, and the fact that it's the 30 year of this process, climate talks, we hope that there will be a big milestones and big outcomes will come out of it. So that's the high hopes. And then people are saying that, oh, that's gonna be the people's COP. That's gonna be now the COP for once is coming down to the most marginalized affected communities to own this process and take over and then push for leaders to do the right thing. So there's potential and there's hope that, you know, the civil society started organizing, they started discussing, and wider movement as they started connecting from the Global South to the movements in the Brazil. We already started conversations to put a very big, you know, push ahead of COP 30, but also during that whole process. So there's strong belief, but also in the Global South are hopeful that the outcomes will be great.
So you don't think that the fossil fuel industry, for instance, won't come out with their lobbyists? Because one of the complaints from civic society in particular was that there was just so many lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry in the last two COPs, this one and the one before. You don't think that they would come out with more lobbyists to really to hijack the process in Brazil?
Yeah, no, that is obvious. This year alone, and this has been increasing, we have received over 2,000 fossil fuel lobbyists in COP 29, and last year the same. So the number is increasing. The host countries plus the presidency have given lancing to fossil fuel lobbies to come into space that they're supposed not to be invited in, because they are the major responsible. About 80% of the fossil fuel crisis, or sorry, climate crisis generally, is caused by the fossil fuel industry. So if you're giving them licensing to come and tickets to come into this negotiation, they will influence, they pass in false solutions, they are passing in narratives that are not helpful to our government, especially countries in the global south, like I would say in Africa. We've seen them peddling the whole carbon markets, you know, idea of, you know, selling our forest to fossil fuel industries to give them licensing to continue to pollute the environment. So that's been, you go into the COPs, you find them, they have their own stores, they have their own pavilions selling this narrative to governments. And they're saying that, oh, this is a form of giving money and creating money for you to fight against climate, which is a false solution, a dangerous destruction methodology that has been peddled by these people. So we have a campaign that Khan is part of and others are working with. It's called the Kick Big Polluters Out. So we're pushing on these industries not to come to COP. We're asking the COP presidency, we're asking the UNFCCC to kick these big polluters out of COP spaces. This year we did innovative actions like the snake, we describe them as a snake, that they cannot come in and serve as green snakes in the green grass when they are the major responsible of, they need to be exposed, that they cannot come into those spaces. But they are always finding their way in. And then I think that we might not be able to do anything about it. They will come into Brazil, but we have to be together in fighting against their false narrative and false solutions.
One thing you just talked about is the carbon market issue. If you could explain to us again, because you did talk about it last time, but refresh our memories on that process. And also, if you could also expand on whether that system, this carbon market system had, from this COP, has been expanded.
Yeah. It's one of the proposals that that we've seen some of the European or global North countries have proposed, like the US and others, kind of proposing to the global South as a climate financing model, that you know you can sell your forest to the fossil fuel industry, but selling that forest to them is giving them licensing to continue to pollute. And then communities that own that forest will not have access to that forest for a number of years. And then, but the fossil fuel industry that have bought that forest will be giving licensing through credit rating to be able to continue to pollute, because they said they are contributing to the carbon credit in itself. So which is completely a false solution, and it's a dangerous distraction, because it's not really contributing to reducing the carbon dioxide contribution that these polluters are doing. So it's completely false strategy that one will say maybe it's giving money to countries, but in a false way. Money have to be given more genuinely, but it have to be on grant-based finances. It have to come from public funds that the developed world governments are raising from their taxpayers' money, so that it can go directly to addressing the climate crisis that our countries are living with. I will say, as we speak right now, before COP, just a few weeks before COP, Senegal had experienced big floods because of the impact of climate. And you cannot enter that community, because of the heavy floods, communities have been submerged, farms have been submerged, livelihoods have been submerged. So what is causing that is the impact of climate. Last year, Mozambique had to borrow money from World Bank to respond to climate. That cannot continue. When countries are hit by climate crisis, they cannot respond. So there must be a critical finance that is put on the table. And that proposal has been very clear this year. It has been said that, you know, well-calculated finance have been reasonably put on the table, that 1.5, 1.3 trillion grant-based public finance that is granular have to be proposed, have to be agreed by this COP29. But unfortunately, they failed to agree on it and they went and proposed 300 billion, which is, you know, too small, too little, poor quality of finance that cannot address the climate crisis. So our communities will continue to suffer. They will continue to face the brunt of the climate crisis. And that comes along with a lot of consequences because people will migrate. Because when people's livelihood are completely eroded by floods and droughts and other climate catastrophes, they will like, they have to run and look for food. They have to run and look for survival. So at the end of the day, we will see a lot of migration in Europe, migration in the US and many other places that are so-called developed countries. So the impact is going to be hard on our governments, but also going to be hard on the citizens and livelihoods.
And also, as we're talking about that, the carbon market process was heavily emphasized again, right? I wanted to get that clarity in this particular process from yes. The global north that, and also the fossil fuel and lobbyists.
Definitely. It has been one of the financing models that have been proposed strongly as the, when we talk about climate finance, carbon credits or carbon markets should be one of the options because it's proposing money to global south by fossil fuel industry and the global north. Countries are proposing this, to our global south countries to accept this. But the civil society is very clear about this. We are asking our government to reject these bad deals, to reject these false solutions. When you talk about climate finance, we are saying that it have to be public fund, it have to be quality fund, it have to be grant-based, granular, no false solutions proposed like greenwashing or carbon credits should not be accepted.
And as you said before, this conference was supposed to be the finance COP, as some have dubbed it. And some people have said that in past COPs, the experts on finance or civic society focus on environmental finance or government officials in charge of finance were not there. Some have said that because of that, there was a lack of finance experts, and that was one of the problems at COP29, which was dubbed Finance COP. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, it's a disappointing COP. I told one of my colleagues, a few of my colleagues, that, you know, this COP from the beginning of it, it had been slow. Have been slow from the beginning of it to the end. Maybe it's deliberately designed that way, and the global north did not take it seriously because they know that they need to step up and take responsibility and put finance on the table. Leadership from many of the global north countries did not come. You know, they did not come to COP. You know, a lot of leaders did not come when you look at compared to other COPs. But again, the critical people, decision makers, did not come to really put serious commitment. So they downplayed everything. The pen was held by maybe influence, not held, but influenced by others in the global north. And then that gave us a very bad results.
You're listening to a recent conversation with Dakar-based activist Mohamed Lamine Sadja Khan, who is head of Building Power Department at the Climate Action Network International, CAN International. Mohamed Lamine Saja Khan attended the climate conference in Baku, COP29. The conversation dissects the outcomes of COP29. The music in the background is Gurima by Chinoiso Marere. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your Jazz and Justice station. You're welcome to join your Jazz and Justice station for a holiday celebration on December 15. The holiday party features music by DJs Abby, Lance Reynolds, and Funk, and light refreshments as well. That'll be on Sunday, December 15, 4:30 to 9 p.m. And that'll be at WPFW's headquarters here at 1990 K Street Northwest, Suite 14R. That's 1990 K Street Northwest, Suite 14R. Space is limited. You must RSVP before December 13 at wpfwfm.org. Now we're going to go back to the conversation with Dakar-based environmental activist Mohamed Lamine Saja Khan, head of Building Power Department at the Climate Action Network, CAN International, and he's dissecting the outcomes of COP29. And was there adequate representation from this civic society and environmental activists who are environmental finance experts to really push the issue on financing more than before?
Yeah, obviously this journey have started, you know, for months, or let me say years now. Like, for example, Climate Action Network International have heavily invested, you know, work around climate finance, but also put in a lot of proposals and scrutinizing these proposals, had a lot of rounds of discussions and engagement with governments, with stakeholders, and also bringing the wider movement together and building the capacity. So we've gone through rounds and rounds of engagements before COPs. But again, you know, coming up with even numbers and how these numbers should look like, why should it be quality finance? Why should it be public funds? Why should it be granular? A lot of details have been thought through, and the sources of funds, where should it come from? Analysis around whether the money is even available. All of those have been, you know, confirmed and based on those engagements. So, and there have been a unity of voices, unity of focus from the civil society, both intellectually, but also even at the activism, real activism level, to push for quality finance and a good quantum to be agreed in this COP. So a lot of preparation, a lot of intellectual capacity have been put in this COP. But unfortunately, global North leaders failed to take responsibility again.
Again, that's Mohamed Lamine Saja Khan. He is head of Building Power Department at the Climate Action Network, that is CAN, as CAN International, Climate Action Network International. And we are dissecting the recently concluded COP29, which is in Baku, Azerbaijan, in November. That's Conference of the Parties, which is the parties of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was adopted in 1992, put in force in 1994. So one thing which keeps coming back is lobbyists and countries who are heavily invested in fossil fuels. Could you detail some of those countries who were lurking in the background in this particular COP? Of course, you have the host country, Azerbaijan, that's a fossil fuel country, which is, I think, over 90% of its export earnings, it comes from fossil fuels. So, yeah, that's one country which is openly, again, it's ambiguous how it's going to be dealing with climate change. And then you have other countries as well. What are other countries who are there were lurking in the background in terms of lobbying for minimizing the action to be taking?
Right. We have tried to expose many of these countries. We have a tool, a kind called the Fossil of the Day, that exposes name and same countries that have been the main blockers of the climate negotiations based on our kind priority or based on the priorities of kind. And the first award of this Fossil of the Day went to the G7 countries. And the G7 countries, you know, have been heavily criticized for being the major drakkers or blockers of not for money not to come on the table as they need to show leadership, because these G7 countries are one of the major polluters, polluting countries, generally, and then they refuse to really take responsibility and put money on the table. US, UK, France, Germany, Japan, you know, Canada, and all of that, they have been major polluting, historically polluting countries. But again, even Australia, but when you look at the history of COP this past three or past year, last year we had it in Dubai. They are one of the major oil producing countries as well, polluting countries. They have also been playing a lot of, you know, this greenwashing or carbon credit, carbon markets initiatives, pushing it in many parts of Africa. Like, for example, Liberia and others like Zambia have sold about 10% of their land to some of these UAE companies for this carbon markets and carbon credit. So again, Australia is hopefully going to be another host of COP. They have also been a major, second largest oil producing country after Russia. So Russia is another critical country. So these have been exposed. We have awarded them all this Fossil of the Day, try to expose, name them and shame them so that they will do the right thing. But they're never sinful enough to do the right thing, but they follow their interests, the economy, the capitalist economic interest that is based on the fossil fuel industry. That's what they try to push, but they always want to show the world that yes, we are climate champions, which is not true. Because if they are climate champions, they would have done the needful by putting money on the table, especially at this critical finance COP.
And how about countries like Saudi Arabia or even India? Because of course India touts itself to be a champion for the global south, but then of course there's a huge production of coal in their country, and they have a huge pollution problem as well. But so what was their role in this COP?
Yeah, Saudi Arabia is very clear, very evident. Saudi Arabia have played some background work here and there. But the great thing that they did was they are supporting the finance agenda. They wanted to have money for the global south. But they have not taken critical steps in moving away from the fossil fuel industry. They have always been quoted and heavily criticized, that they say oil and gas are a gift from God. Even Azerbaijan presidency mentioned that at the beginning of this COP. That so with that kind of mentality, we don't see much progress from them. So Saudi Arabia is one of the major polluting countries. They depend on oil so much and gas. So they have really not taken many progressive steps. India have been very critical about the finance. They have been champions in terms of being vocal and saying that money have to be put on the table. When you look at it historically, the US and others have to take responsibility, more leadership and more responsibility historically because of the historic industrialization, but also continued burning of the fossil fuel industry. But followed by Saudi Arabia and Russia and as well, UAE and others, Qatar and others, they all have been major oil producers now, and they really need to take leadership and transition just like what Colombia did.
And then I wanted to go back to the financing before we conclude as well. And you had talked about this financing being in multilateral institutions. This is the loss and damage financing, right, as we mentioned before, right, which is last time was $700 million was going to be at the 700 billion was to be housed at the World Bank, as we discussed before. And as you had raised concerns of it today as well at that time, of it being housed in multilateral institutions because of the long history of these institutions and their policies to the Global South in really controlling the economies. It's an extension of neo-colonial economic policies. What was in their discussion, if you can expand a bit more from what you were saying at the beginning, was there a push to maintain these multilateral institutions to be the holders of these funds and not really adjusting because the Global South has huge apprehension of these funds being housed in these institutions.
What we have seen in the outcome document or the decisions of this COP is that a lot of emphasis have been put on the multilateral institutions like World Bank and others to be major contributors to this 300 billion financing of climate. But as I said earlier in our last discussion, the institutions have been captured by certain states, and they are neo-colonial institutions that are not really helping the developing countries like countries like Africa that have gone through a lot of challenges to access financing with less conditions. So they come with a lot of conditions. So having the Loss and Damage Fund hosted under the World Bank is, you know, create a lot of eyebrows, you know, by many activists, but also in communities. Because how will they make it more accessible? That we are demanding as civil society that the funds of the Loss and Damage Fund must be accessible by communities, but also must be accessible by civil society and grassroots communities, groups. But, you know, with the conditions and the World Bank systems, that's going to be very challenging. The smaller hope is there is that they said, World Bank will host this for 5-year test. 5 years, we'll host this and we will make it operationalized by next year. So we are watching, we are pushing hard on that. But I want to say that the general disappointing part of what have been allocated in terms of, or what have been suggested to be allocated in terms of finance, is with 300 billion, which is even less than what is needed for the adaptation finance. You know, so adaptation finance required over 300 billion, 308 something billion is required for adaptation finance. And what is proposed is just 300 billion, which is not even quality money. It have to come with many other conditions or many other things, factors in terms of contribution. So as we speak, only 61 billion have been, you know, allocated for adaptation finance. When you look at the magnitude of crisis and the magnitude of efforts that countries have to take to adapt to the climate crisis, especially those in the Global South. So it's really, really not fair to the communities and leave communities alone when they don't cause the brunt of the crisis themselves. So the financial mechanisms or institutions that have been there are not really working. They are all controlled. When you look at the World Bank structure, who owns World Bank, who controls the World Bank, who makes the decision about on issues around World Bank. And if they're going to be the institution that is going to host this money, the Loss and Damage Fund. But small countries like my country, Gambia, or uninfluential countries like Senegal and others, will they really be able to change things or demand for things in their way? You know, those are critical questions. As I've mentioned earlier, many, many smaller island states, you know, will be submerged by sea level rise in the coming years if no action is taken. So people's lives are on the line. What we have been saying clearly is that it's not just about the amount or numbers, but it's about lives and livelihood of people that are at the center of this whole discussion and the whole COP issue, especially when we talk about finance, because those finances that have been demanded by communities, by activist groups, are going to potentially save life and uplift life from the crisis that they have not caused themselves.
So before we go, I just want you to talk about what is next for civic society organizations like the ones you're with and beyond in the environmental movement on this issue, and also the greater community in between this COP and the one that's going to take place in Brazil next year, which will be COP 30.
Yeah, climate crisis is in our hands. It's facing us every second. And it's hitting us every second or minute. People are dying out of it. We are seeing it evidently. That is why it has to be a critical issue for every living person on earth. So we all have to collectively work together to push on our leaders at every level of leadership to do the right thing. But for those people who are living in the global north, they have a major responsibility because their leaders have to do the right decisions, take the right decisions, and take the and they have a lot of power that they can influence the decisions of these processes, especially the COP processes. So as we go into COP 30, everybody should be an advocate. Everybody should be a climate activist, a champion, and to push for leaders to do the right thing and push for leaders to, you know, advance the agenda of transitioning from the fossil fuel industry as the major responsible of the climate crisis to a renewable energy, but also a renewable life and development model that will help save lives, but also save the earth and planet for all of us. So, you know, it's a matter of collective power that we all have, that nobody is safe. I will end by saying that we are in a boat together. This boat will sink. And when it sinks, there'll be no first class or second class. That is how the climate crisis is facing us. We are in a boat together. If we don't act together to save ourselves, there'll be no first class or second class. We're all going to sink together. So it's better for us to act together so we save lives, but also save our planet for all of us.
Lamine, thank you very much again for being with us once again to dissect the COP 29.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you again. I hope we all act as climate champions and to save ourselves and save the world together.
Thank you. You've just been listening to a conversation with Dakar-based activist Mohamed Lamine Sadja Khan, head of Building Power Department at the Climate Action Network International, CAN International. Mohamed Lamine Sadja Khan attended the climate conference in Baku, Azerbaijan in November. The conversation dissects the outcomes of the climate conference, which is also known as COP 29, Conference of the Parties of the 1992 UN Climate Agreement. You can revisit that conversation as well as a previous one setting up the issues that were going to be discussed at the COP 29 on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Sabukwe by Ezra Gukukana. And we play that remembering South African liberation leader Robert Sobukwe, who would have turned 100 on December 5. On Friday, December 6th, at 6 p.m., there will be a program honoring the centennial birthday of Robert Mangaliso Sobukwe at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe. That's 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest. The event features the updated version of the film Sobukwe, A Great Soul by Mickey Madoda Dube, followed by a panel discussion featuring the filmmaker and also Sepo Sobukwe, the grandson of Robert Sobukwe, and Nancy Wright of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Information is available at sankofa.com/events or at Sobukwe, that's S-O-B-U-K-W-E, at at100.eventbrite.com. That's Sobukwe at 100.eventbrite.com. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shanana Hussein Alamin, looking at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East. And that's followed by the women's collective, Sophie's Parlor, and which is followed by the Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Kombit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nicella and Claire Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Shanda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Oderson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW, beginning on Giving Tuesday, December 3rd through the 31st. We ask you to embrace radical generosity and donate to WPFW. Visit wpfwfm.org to donate. Your year-end gift is essential to WPFW's ability to continue to build a better world one broadcast at a time. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Flying Bird, Anome by Osibisa, commemorating Osibisa's founder, leader, Teddy Osei's birthday, which is December 1st. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe. Thank you.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
Happy holiday. I'm Robin Holden.
I'm Miyuki Williams. WPFW is wishing you a happy holiday and are inviting our listeners to an open house extravaganza as we say goodbye to our 1990 K Street location.
We're offering our listeners and supporters this holiday gathering as a way of thanking you for your support. On Sunday, December 15th, from 4:30 p.m. until 7:30 p.m.,
stellar programmers James Funk,
Captain Fly,
DJ Lance Reynolds,
and DJ Abby will provide the music.
Food and drink will be made available.
Details, including how to RSVP, available at WPFWFM.org.
Happy holidays!
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. South Korean opposition lawmakers submitted a motion today to impeach President Yoon Suk-yeol over his short-lived effort yesterday to place the country under martial law. The motion, submitted jointly by the main liberal opposition Democratic Party and five smaller opposition parties, could be put to a vote as early as Friday. After introducing the impeachment motion, the Democratic Party condemned Yoon's initial martial law declaration as, quote, insurrectionary behavior. Meanwhile, the country's largest union group said members would strike until the president quits. Impeaching Yoon would require the support of two-thirds of parliament, and at least six justices of the nine-member constitutional court would have to endorse it to remove him from office. If Yoon quits or is removed from office, under the Constitution, Prime Minister Han Duck-soo will step in to perform presidential duties. The Associated Press is reporting that rival Palestinian factions are near an agreement to appoint a politically neutral group of technocrats to run the Gaza Strip following Israel's war in the territory. Such an agreement between Hamas and the West Bank-based Fatah would effectively end Hamas's rule in Gaza and could help reignite peace talks. Israeli officials have repeatedly ruled out any post-war role in Gaza for either Hamas or Fatah. The AP cited a Palestinian official who said a preliminary agreement calls for a committee of 12 to 15 members, mostly from Gaza, which would report to the West Bank-based Palestinian Authority. A Hamas official said details of the agreement were still being negotiated, including who would serve on the committee. Previous attempts at a unity agreement between Fatah and Hamas have failed. Israel's retaliatory war in Gaza has killed over 44,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, and destroyed most of the territory's infrastructure. In domestic news, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments this morning in a case focused on Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for trans youth. U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar delivered opening arguments against the Tennessee ban and answered questions from justices on gender dysphoria and the history of de jure discrimination against trans people. ACLU attorney Chase Strangio also delivered arguments against the ban. Potential swing votes on the court include Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Neil Gorsuch, both of whom ruled in favor of trans people in a 2020 workplace discrimination case. Another swing vote, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, was not on the court for the 2020 case. Both Roberts and Barrett have asked questions this morning suggesting support for the Tennessee ban. The court's other three conservative justices, Alito, Kavanaugh, and Thomas, dissented in the 2020 case, suggesting they will rule in favor of the ban. Supporters of rights for trans people gathered outside the court this morning to protest. Pete Hegseth, Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of Defense, is fighting to hold on to his cabinet nomination as some key GOP senators raise questions about his personal conduct and whether he can make it through the confirmation process. Hegseth has already been the subject of accusations of sexual assault from 2017, accusations he denies. But fresh revelations emerged over the weekend involving alcohol abuse and sexual misconduct in his past. With the GOP's slim incoming Senate majority, Hegseth can afford to lose only 3 Republican votes, assuming all Democrats vote